This series contains adult language and depictions of graphic violence. Listener discretion is advised. Pop quiz. What's the oldest city in the United States? Before this weekend, I would have guessed Jamestown, Virginia. And I would have been wrong. There's a city a few hundred miles south of Virginia and John Smith that beats Jamestown by more than 40 years. The oldest continuously inhabited European-founded city in the continental United States is St. Augustine, Florida. Look, I'd love to give this honor to a village inhabited by Native Americans, but permanence wasn't really their jam. They were nomadic, following the food and resources until it was time for winter camp, then they'd be on the move again for greener pastures. It wasn't until the government drove them off all the good land and onto permanent reservations that any type of Native American, quote, cities came to be. It's those pesky Europeans, with all their thirst for conquest and ownership and naming things after themselves, their kings, or their gods, that established trading posts and military forts and villages and ports. And, well, St. Augustine is one of those. The oldest one of those, actually, in what would become the United States of America more than 200 years later. But not the first. The French were first, and of course, the Native Americans that have lived there for thousands of years. But the Spanish were the world's superpower at the time. And the French forts and the villages of the Mocama and the Timucua weren't exactly welcome to hold onto their land once the Spanish started flexing. And they really liked St. Augustine. Strategic defense position, facing the waterways, abundant resources, that nice sunny weather. I was in Florida for a family event over the weekend, Miami to be exact, and it had been years since I spent any time in the Sunshine State, so my curiosity was piqued, and I asked some locals about the spookiest places, towns, maybe ghost stories that they were the most proud of. See, I was once told that if you were looking for a good tailor, you ask around until you hear the same name three times and then run to that person. Same with ghost stories. So I had three different people mention St. Augustine as being the most haunted place in Florida within an hour of my asking, and one spot in particular. We'll get to that spot in a minute, but first, some quick history of the state of Florida. Ponce de Leon was a Spaniard of noble birth who first crossed the Atlantic on the second expedition of Christopher Columbus in 1493. He rose quickly in the military ranks of Hispaniola, an island that today is comprised of Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and he was then authorized to explore the nearby island of Puerto Rico in 1508 and went on to become the island's first governor in 1509, appointed by the Spanish crown. In 1513, De Leon led the first known European expedition to Florida. Upon landfall, somewhere along the peninsula's east coast, he named the land La Florida, or the Land of the Flowers, as he was so taken by the lush greenery he saw in all directions. But then business and politics had Ponce de Leon going back and forth between Spain and Florida, until 1521, when he returned to Southwest Florida with the orders to establish a permanent Spanish colony, which would have been the first in the continental United States. However, he was fiercely opposed by the local Calusa native tribes, and several violent confrontations occurred. De Leon was mortally wounded in one such skirmish, dying from his wounds days later in Cuba. But the die was cast, and Florida was a hit with the Spanish, and soon the French, and then the English, and then the New Yorkers. But seriously, for the next 300 years, Florida would be an important piece of what would become the American experiment. Welcome back to The Devil Within. You're listening to Tales from the Sunshine State. Today, Florida is the third most populous state in our union. It boasts the fourth largest state economy and sets the bar for industries such as tourism, hospitality, agriculture, real estate. It has world-famous beaches and amusement parks, the Kennedy Space Center, the Florida Keys, several professional sports teams, a rich and diverse population, and hundreds of insane news headlines featuring, quote, Florida man getting caught doing things that just can't be real. After changing hands several times, which we'll get to in a minute, Florida became the 27th state on March 3, 1845, with the ratification of the Constitution. Florida was also the location of the Seminole Wars, the costliest and longest of the so-called Indian Wars that the U.S. government unfortunately engaged in. I mean, Hemingway lived and worked there, which is awesome. But then there was all the sorry business of Indian removal, which, by an act of Congress, forced the Seminoles out of Florida to eventually settle in Oklahoma. And yeah, Disney World is great, but for decades, nearly all the cocaine in America came through Florida. So, really high highs and super low lows. That's Florida, baby. Plus, they have huge alligators and also an invasive species problem that sees giant anacondas currently taking over the Everglades. So, as Ponce de Leon was charting the east coast of Florida, moving south to north, he was also, allegedly, looking for the fabled Fountain of Youth. He may have gotten as far north as a place that would, two generations later, be named St. Augustine. This settlement would grow to a military fort, then a village, then a town, and then a city that would one day serve as the capital of the region, and could very well have been the capital of the state, but the government was moved to Tallahassee. But still, the city of St. Augustine would survive uninterrupted from its founding up until this very day. The year was 1560, and King Philip II of Spain appointed a man named Pedro Menendez Aviles as captain general and gave him command of the famed Spanish treasure fleet, the fleet that plied the tropical waters from the Caribbean to Mexico and determined the routes back to Spain that future conquistadors would follow. But in 1563, the fleet was scattered by a hurricane off the Carolina coast, and the fleet's flagship, La Concepcion, was lost. La Concepcion was commanded by Admiral Juan Menendez, the Captain General's son. Upon the remaining fleet's return to Spain, Pedro Menendez asked permission to return immediately to search for the lost ship, believing that the ship was close enough to shore that it may have survived the storm, but was wrecked on the beach somewhere. Repeated requests were denied until the Crown figured out a way to make it worth their while. Captain Menendez was approached with an offer of an outfitted ship, sure, to look for La Concepcion, but ultimately to explore Florida, to settle the region in the name of King Philip and eliminate those pesky, heretical French Huguenots. After all, the Spanish weren't just Catholic. They were Catholic at you. It would turn out that Menendez had very little time to search for his son, as he was in a race to reach Florida ahead of a fresh batch of Frenchmen en route to secure their meager military outposts. Menendez got there first, and his soldiers were able to overpower the outmanned and outgunned Huguenots. The women and children were spared, but the men were killed and hanged from trees with warning signs in front of them that read, "Executed, not as Frenchmen, but as Lutherans." Ah, religion. But St. Augustine was established, named after the day Menendez's ship first spotted the Florida coast. It was August 28, 1565, the day of the Feast of St. Augustine on the Catholic calendar. The city has survived attacks by the French, invasion by pirates, even the English privateer Sir Francis Drake completely sacked the city in 1586 and burned it to the ground. I guess if you're English, you're a privateer. Anything else, then you're a pirate. Anyway, There were more attacks, burnings, and lootings throughout the 1600s, which prompted the Spanish crown to fund the construction of a masonry fort, built out of sedimentary rock hewn from local quarries that would provide adequate protection from future attacks. It was called the Castillo San Marcos. It took 20 years to build and was completed in 1695. The fort still stands today and is a major tourist attraction in St. Augustine. Then, in 1763, England defeated France and Spain in the Seven Years' War, and Florida suddenly became the property of Great Britain. But not for long. After the American War for Independence, Florida was returned to Spain until a negotiated treaty was ratified in 1821, and Florida became a United States territory, with St. Augustine as its capital. Soon, though, the territorial government would move its headquarters to Tallahassee, leaving St. Augustine as a storied, repeatedly sacked, hurricane-ravaged survivor of a city in northeast Florida. When Florida seceded from the Union in January of 1861, General Lee ordered all lighthouses be rendered useless, beginning with the lighthouse in St. Augustine. So Confederate troops dismantled and hid the lenses before moving south and doing the same on every lighthouse on the eastern coast of Florida. But their hijinks wouldn't last long because in 1862, a Union blockade would bring St. Augustine to its knees, and the Union would control the city for the remainder of the war. But that lighthouse. For decades, the watchtower that was built in conjunction with the military fort at San Marcos was used as the lighthouse. It was this structure that the Confederate troops sabotaged in 1861. However, by 1867, the light and lenses had been recovered and it was again fully functional. Functional except for the part where, you know, it was about to collapse into the sea. Natural erosion from the tides had slowly been reclaiming the piece of land the tower stood on, and it was dangerously close to catastrophic failure. By 1871, Congress had approved funding for a proper lighthouse tower at St. Augustine, and they hired a man named Hezekiah Petit, a builder from Maine who was an expert in all things lighthouses. Hezekiah soon arrived with his wife and four children and got to work. Within 2 years, the tower was roughly 25% complete, but that time included all the prep work that went into construction, including the building of a loading dock to receive materials from the sea, as well as laying down a railroad line from the dock to the construction site to make delivery of material to the site way easier than using mules or human labor. But for what they saved in convenience, they lost something far greater. As kids do, they make just about anything into an opportunity for fun and games. Imagine being an unsupervised child with free rein on a construction site. A construction site that had its own freaking roller coaster. That's how the Petit children saw the railroad. A roller coaster. They would climb into the newly emptied cart and take the ride all the way down to the dock, screaming with glee as they flew through the sweet Florida sunshine. But on one fateful day, the three Petit sisters, along with the daughter of a construction foreman, climbed into the empty cart as they had done countless times and held on for the thrilling ride to the dock. But on this day, the mechanism that was designed to stop the cart at the track's terminus malfunctioned, and the cart plunged into the water below, flipped over as it was submerged, and trapped the children beneath the cart at the bottom of the bay. By the time the workers realized what had happened, the only girl still breathing was the youngest Petit sister. Hezekiah, with his wife and his remaining children, returned to Maine to bury their dead and would never see the completed lighthouse. But many say the spirits of his daughters remained. In the 150 years since the tragedy, stories of phantom encounters with playful ghosts have become commonplace at the now historic St. Augustine Lighthouse. From footsteps to giggling sounds emanating from empty floors of the tower, to the sighting of fully formed apparitions that, for 20 years, caused the keeper's house to stand vacant. Although the stories are never violent, they're often mischievous and very, very consistent. During one particular tour of the lighthouse and keeper's house offered by the St. Augustine Historical Society, a woman had arrived early and was standing on the bottom step of the staircase that led to the lobby of the lighthouse. A few minutes later, as the guide and other guests arrived, she moved to climb the stairs but found her shoelace had been tied to the railing. Then there's the ghost hunter who claims to have played a full game of hide-and-seek with the ghosts of the Petit sisters using an EMF detector. It's a device used by ghost hunters that supposedly tracks electrical activity caused by spirits. During another tour of the grounds, a woman was approached by a fellow tourist who remarked that the woman's daughter was very well behaved. Confused, the woman replied that she didn't have a daughter. The woman was then informed by several members of the tour that a little girl had been standing beside her for the entire tour, although no children were listed for the event that day. Do the ghosts of the young Petit sisters haunt the grounds of the St. Augustine Lighthouse? Maybe. Maybe not. Either way, St. Augustine is a beautiful city, rich in history that dates back almost 500 years. If you're ever in northern Florida, you should definitely check it out. Just down the coast from St. Augustine is a small Florida community that claims to be the psychic capital of the world. The town is called Casadega, and psychics or not, it's a creepy place. It all started in 1874 when a spiritualist named George P. Colby claimed he was contacted by the deceased spirit of a Native American named Seneca. Prior to this revelation, Colby traveled the country as a trance medium, basically a precursor to Edgar Cayce, the guy that would claim to have visions of the future while he slept and performed readings in his sleep. This cat, George Colby, was like that, a trance medium. Anyway, he claimed Seneca told him to go to Florida and start a spiritualist camp. So, Colby landed in Florida in a place called Blue Springs Landing and received a charter from the county to found the Casadega Spiritualist Camp. He named the camp after a town near Lilydale, New York, where he first began attending spiritualist camp himself. Soon, there were a bunch of charlatans living a communal lifestyle and running scams on people desperate to talk to their dearly departed. By 1894, the camp had grown to 57 acres and became a town in its own right. As always, when someone claims to know something unknowable, you know, like what happens to someone after they die, the detractors come out of the woodwork and claim, "No, no, we know the unknowable, and you're doing the work of the devil." In fact, it was soon determined by the most conservative in the religious community that Casadega was the actual physical, earthly home of the devil himself. We've talked about spiritualism before on the show. As a practice, it's thought to have begun in the 1840s with two sisters in New York who claimed to be able to communicate with the dead by making tapping noises and hearing them in return in their home. As the movement grew, church leaders began to freak out, afraid that they might lose their singular influence over the life-after-death stuff. I mean, what if they were wrong? A campaign to discredit spiritualism was launched, and many of the early practitioners were exposed as frauds. An unlikely ally in the anti-spiritualist fight was none other than legendary magician Harry Houdini, who was able to easily determine that magicians were being employed by these so-called mediums to prove their authenticity. But still, the town does a brisk business. The camp educates and trains their own spiritualists with between 4 and 6 years of classes necessary to become an official medium at the Casadega camp. Why so long? Supposedly, only those truly gifted in spiritual matters will fully commit to the rigorous training. Okay. In their defense, the camp is leaving a lot of money on the table because they routinely lack the staff to accommodate all those who arrive looking for a reading. But it hasn't always been Ouija boards and seances, although there is an awful lot of Ouija boards and seances. In the 1960s, rumors began to circulate, rumors of human sacrifice and satanic worship, with bodies being dumped in a nearby lake and strange pagan rituals going late into the night. And many of those stories revolve around what's known as the Devil's Chair. A Devil's Chair dates back to the Victorian era, when cemeteries were designed more like parks, and families would often spend the days there, picnicking, relaxing, and visiting the graves of their lost loved ones. Many of these cemeteries would have large, stone or brick, throne-type chairs constructed at various points along the walking paths. They were very gothic-looking, intimidating, kind of not inviting to sit in chairs that many people think were never actually meant to sit in, but were purely ornamental. You know, graveyard chic. So as the years went by and these scary cemetery chairs were sat in by exactly no one, they evolved into something else. Myth and ceremony were heaped upon them, and soon it was, you know, if you sit in a devil's chair long enough, you'll actually summon a demon. So suddenly every drunk college kid, determined to answer a dare, would plop himself down on one of these and get super scared. And the Casadega Devil's Chair is itself supposedly haunted along with the cemetery it calls home. Yeah, a haunted chair in a haunted graveyard. So, the big question, has anything actually happened to anyone who has sat in this haunted chair? Well, first off, the chair supposedly sits on a vortex, one of several alleged vortices on the grounds of Casadega. The spiritualist claim is that a vortex is a specific area on planet Earth that has a concentrated level of psychic activity and possibly could be a portal to other dimensions. People who have sat on the Devil's Chair in Casadega claim to have heard strange voices in their heads that wouldn't stop until they got off the chair. Another claim is that if you leave an unopened can of beer on the chair, that it's empty in the morning. Empty, but still unopened. Okay. The really scary story involves a kid from nearby Orlando who took the dare to sit on the Devil's Chair at the stroke of midnight on Halloween. This kid's nuts. His friends watched him walk into the misty Halloween darkness toward the chair, and then he completely vanished and was never seen again. Did the devil appear and drag him into hell? Was he swallowed by the vortex and is currently living in an alternate dimension? Did he walk back to Orlando and take a job as a Disney character at Epcot? No one knows, and the story has never been corroborated. But look, if you're seriously a believer in the ability of a spiritually gifted medium to actually communicate with someone who has died, then Casadega should definitely be on your bucket list. It's a short drive from Disney World and apparently worth the trip. There's also a great Italian place in Casadega called Sinatra's, so it can't be all bad. Thanks for listening. Make sure you're following The Devil Within wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. And you can also check out our socials at The Devil Within Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Until next time, stay safe out there. The Devil Within is a Cloud 10 Media production, recorded live at Bel Air Studios in Los Angeles, California. Written and produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Sim Sarna. Our post-production supervisor is Bruce Witkin, who also provided original music for this episode. For The Devil Within, I'm your host, Brandon Morgan.